The following program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cane5.com.
Okay, terrific music. Thank you, Jack. This is The Naturalist, and I'm here with Bernie Wides.
Hi, folks.
And this is Carol Butler, and we are at Roberta's Restaurant, and we are hopefully will entertain you with some interesting conversation. As we were coming in this morning, we met a young lady who's the gardener here at Roberta's, and her name, you remember her name?
I'll look it up for you.
Okay. Yeah. And we have a garden on the roof of the recording studio as well as in the back area. There's a big yard, and some of the food that we eat here is grown locally right above us.
Right.
The lettuce is wonderful. They grow that upstairs. So we are going to interview her in our next show.
Right. On the, what is it, the 27th, I think.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, her name is Melissa.
Melissa, okay. Right. She's very lovely, and I'm looking forward to it because it's really fascinating local gardening here in the middle of Bushwick, Brooklyn. And so we'll learn all about what they're doing and how they're planting on the roof. And
yeah, we're going to do a whole show on gardening. So if you have any questions or comments on it, just send us a comment, right?
Right, and comment right on our Facebook page. We promise to look.
Right.
And we will incorporate your questions when we have the show on gardening next time. So today I have one of my mishmashes of a variety of topics, hopefully all interesting. The first one is an update on the white nose syndrome, which is the disease that's been killing bats for the last few years. The latest report as of May 25th is that white nose syndrome was confirmed in Maine, Oxford County, Maine. And Maine, up until this time, had been the only northeastern state that did not have white nose syndrome. They hadn't been detected there. It's now confirmed in 17 United States and 4 Canadian provinces. And the fungus that causes white nose syndrome, which we talked about in an earlier show, the fungus is in an additional 2 states, although they haven't had any bats affected that they know of yet.
By the way, Carol, we should add about your book on bats. It's a terrific book.
Thank you. I did a book with Barbara Schmidt-French called Do Bats Drink Blood, which we talk a lot about white nose syndrome as well as all kinds of other really fascinating, but they are just fascinating little creatures.
They are little mammals.
Right. Right. So that's certainly available if you're interested. It's discounted, and you can find it at Amazon or on the Rutgers Press website, where Rutgers published it. It's part of my series of books. Okay, so that's the update. White nose syndrome is still spreading. There was a big conference in Little Rock, Arkansas in May, where a bunch of scientists and wildlife managers came together to talk about what's happening in the research. And there was some encouraging news, but still nothing that I can report that's to say this is under control, nothing that's really conclusive. So this is still a big problem for the bats. Okay, switching gears. I'm going to talk about paper wasps. There's some very interesting new research.
Do we have paper wasps locally?
Yes.
In this part? Right.
Yes, we do.
Do they make those big nests?
I don't know how big the nests are. I'm talking about a specific
okay.
aspect of paper wasp development.
Go ahead.
You know that I wrote a book about bees also called Why Do Bees Buzz? And I learned a lot. Bees are fantastically interesting. They develop as workers, right? Most of this is related to the wasp story. Most of the eggs are females, and the workers change their roles so that their genes are expressed differently as they age and as the colony has different needs. So they might, at one point, a worker might be feeding the babies. At another point, she might be tending to the queen. At another point, she might be foraging when she gets older. So this is the same animal that does all these different tasks depending on developmental stage and on the needs of the colony. There are very few male eggs that are laid, and only if they need a new queen, a special queen cell is built that's larger than the other cells, and the queen larvae are fed a different diet, and they develop into potential queens. Okay, so that's all the complexities. Now, wasps are similar mm-hmm. to bees, right? People mix them up. But it was noticed that when feeding the larvae in a wasp colony, the paper wasp queen and other dominant females beat their antennae in a rhythmic pattern against the nest chambers.
Really?
Where the larvae are. So that's called antennal drumming. And the drumming behavior is clearly audible to a human listener. So that the researchers say it's very conspicuous. And more than once, they have discovered the nests by hearing the tapping of the antenna.
Hmm.
So this in itself is pretty interesting. Yeah. You can imagine the sort of drumming that's loud enough that a human walking by can hear it and identify the location of a wasp nest.
It's like an orchestra with 1,000 drummers.
Exactly. Yeah, it really must be something. I would love to hear it. There is a video, of course, as there is about everything, but I don't know that. And what they call gynes, G-Y-N-E-S, which can become queens, and they're the ones that lay eggs and establish new nests. Workers and gynes hatch from eggs laid by the colony's queen, but the gynes develop stores of body fat and other nutrients that help them survive the winter and give them enough oomph so that they can start a new nest and produce eggs. Workers have very little fat and generally don't lay eggs, which is the same with bee workers,
yeah.
And they die off as the weather turns cold. So the puzzle is, how come out of the same egg, the same genome, can give rise to two such different phenotypes, right?
Yeah.
A fatty animal that has the potential to develop into the queen and a skinny worker. Okay. So honeybees, we know, I just explained that, and the queens receive what we know as royal jelly. They receive a nutrient-rich food.
That's almost the same as the bees.
This is the bees. The bees get a special diet. That's the royal jelly, while the workers receive just stored pollen and nectar.
Yeah.
So we know that there's a dietary difference as well as the size of the capsule in which they emerge. There's no evidence that wasps feed the young workers and gynes any differently.
Hmm.
So they get the same food. So this research found, they simulated it in the lab, that the drumming of the antenna biases the larva towards developing the physiological characteristics of workers rather than gynes.
Hmm.
So that early in the season, when the colonies are pumping out workers to expand and maintain the nest and take care of the young, there isn't very much drumming. There's a lot of drumming. The drumming biases the development towards workers. So the drumming, it's interesting to think about. It's a noise, it's a vibration, it's a disturbance. And so they develop with that disturbance, and they don't accumulate a lot of body fat.
Hmm.
When the work is done, and when you need more queens to go out and lay eggs and develop more colonies, the drumming drops off drastically. And then you get more body fat accumulated and more queens.
It's really?
Like they're, the fantasy, it's anthropomorphizing, but you think about it, they're undisturbed, they're just kind of laying around eating, they're not responding, they're not agitated by the drumming, And they're more likely to develop into these potential queens.
That sounds like some women I know who thought they were queens. They just lied around and then nothing.
Right. Well, I mean, it's very much. It seems to me very much related to stress.
You mean the stress of the drumming?
Yes, you're inducing stress with the vibrations of the drumming. And I think that is the hypothesis anyway, which makes sense to me, is that affects the development and makes it more likely that they develop into lean workers.
Hmm. You hear that, Jack? It's a good thing you didn't become a drummer, right?
That's right.
And Carlos, how about you? Yeah. All right.
And there is some research with mice where they found that young mice exposed to low-frequency vibrations developed less fat and more bone mass than other mice. So whether that has anything to do with wasps or not, but yeah. It's very interesting. And it's the first case where a mechanical vibratory signal that an animal has evolved appears to modulate the development of members of its own species.
Yeah, and so. It's even in the audible range. We can hear it. So
absolutely,
I wonder
yeah.
if you, you know... If you play that for your kids, a recording of that drumming,
right?
You think it would affect them? I don't know.
If a pregnant woman lived near a nest with these wasps and they were drumming, would it affect the child?
I don't know. We're going to have to play science fiction music for
we
this.
We can't go thing, too right? far with this. We can't go too far with this. Okay. So switching from wasps, let's talk about leeches.
Oh, we're finished with wasps now.
So we're finished with wasps.
The main thing was about the drumming.
The drumming, yes. No, that was
That's
just a
really
new little bit.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm.
So, leeches. Leeches are ectotherms, right?
Tell us what that means,
Carol. Bernie knows what that means.
Okay.
That means they're cold-blooded animals.
Right.
They can't regulate their own temperature, and so they depend on the environment to do it for them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if they need to be warmer, they need to move physically to a warmer place if they want to warm up.
They go to Florida a lot, I think.
So they eat large meals. They're bloodsuckers, right? So,
but they don't eat very often, right? Those
that's
leeches?
Right. That's right. They eat large meals, and that's right. You did a show on leeches.
That's right.
So
I had the leech lady.
Right, you had the leech lady. So
she was terrific.
Yeah, she was. That was very interesting. All right, so this is a little coda to the leech show.
Okay.
They eat big meals, and then they use up a lot of energy digesting the meals and excreting the waste. And they spend months between meals. So in order to digest quickly... excuse me, efficient digestion, right, would be an evolutionary advantage because
mm-hmm.
they can't move when they're full, just like the bed bugs.
They're
when
too bloated.
They're bloated and they're stagnant and they need to get rid of the fluid and the waste so that they can be mobile and search for another meal, which can take a while. So in this new research report, they found that well-fed leeches seek out warmth so that the chemical processes can move faster, while hungry ones preserve energy by moving to cooler places.
Mm-hmm.
And this has never before been seen in an invertebrate species.
Really?
So it's very interesting to me, anyway. It's a very sophisticated strategy in a very simple animal like a leech. I think other invertebrates probably do it, because we certainly know that bed bugs, for example, cluster together,
mm-hmm.
And they move within the cluster to maintain optimal body temperature.
Okay.
They change positions.
It's like penguins.
And I was just going to say, penguins do that. Recently, there was an article about that. Penguins do it in waves, right? They do it in these very minute movements that are hard to see by the naked eye, but they did a video study recently, and they could actually see the shifting.
The shifting, like a wave, it looks like.
Right. And bees do that.
Mm-hmm.
Bees, when they're fasting, when they're in the winter and they are running low on nectar supplies and it's cold, bees also cluster inside the colony, and they change places so that they all have a chance to be in the warmer interior,
right. Yeah.
Rather than just some staying inside, some staying on the outside and freezing. So this is a phenomenon. We know this is this idea of regulating temperature by moving around is not new. But
what about the leeches now?
But the leech, this is new, yeah, with the leeches. This is a new piece of evidence that such a simple animal, because the other animals we're talking about are less simple than a leech. We're talking about insects,
more complex, right.
Insects and penguins, which are much more complex. A leech is a very,
very simple
animal. You know more about the specifics of a leech, but it's really just
A tube,
right, exactly.
With a mouth at one end and a butt at the other end, and the rest of it is the digestive tract.
Exactly. So, but it has no legs. It doesn't, you know, it really is very simple. So it's very interesting.
I had an uncle who was a leech, but he ate more than these leeches. He would eat every Saturday night. He would come over for dinner. So he wasn't there. I'd call him the leech man. But,
okay. All right. On that note, let us take a little break.
We'll take a little break. And we're going to get back to some more exciting stories in the invertebrate world, Carol.
Well, you never know.
And we never know. Carol does this great research.
Are we back?
Okay.
This is Carol Butler and
Bernie Wide.
And back with the Naturalist program. I'm going to have a bunch of things to talk about. Let's see. This is sort of interesting.
Okay.
This is a plant that changes pollinators in order to defend itself.
Really?
Yeah.
Ah, it's now, like going to a supermarket, you mean?
Something like that.
A Chinese restaurant, that would be.
Okay.
One from column A?
Right, okay. Right. I've written about pollinators. It sort of just happened. The first book was about butterflies, and then I wrote about bats and bees and discovered that I was writing about pollinators, and so then did a book on hummingbirds. So all of these animals pollinate different flowers for the most part. There's obviously overlap, but they prefer plants with different shapes, so that they can get their proboscis or their beak or their tongue into it. And they also prefer different thicknesses of nectar because the way that they eat is different. Mm-hmm. We know that butterflies sort of absorb the liquid through the in the proboscis. They don't actually suck it up.
Mm,
bees
right.
have a sucking pump in their head, so they suck the liquid through their proboscis. And hummingbirds have the liquid goes up their tongue.
Right. Is the tongue grooved or something?
Well, they all have sort of it's a two pieces originally like a proboscis,
okay.
And it's fused.
Right.
But they move the tongue in such a way that the liquid goes up the tongue.
Like capillary action.
Who am I leaving out? And bats. Similar
bats.
For bats. Yeah. It's not, okay. Yeah. Capillary action is butterflies and for sure.
Right.
So... animal-pollinated plants need to attract pollinators, so they, while remaining relatively inconspicuous to herbivores, which are animals that eat plants, right, particularly caterpillars, which are the larvae of pollinators, of butterflies and moths. So this is always a paradox. In our butterfly conservatory, we don't have any caterpillars or larvae, because they would destroy the exhibit, and we just can't manage them So we don't have host plants, which are the plants that the caterpillars will eat. They lay eggs on different plants. They lay eggs on host plants, and those are the plants that the caterpillars will eat. So we don't have any host plants.
Right.
And host plants are what get eaten. Okay. So in this case, the plants, it's about, the research was on a night-flowering tobacco plant called Nicotiana. I like that name. Nicotiana attenuate.
Oh, sounds like an old girlfriend. Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
All right. So it germinates after fires in the southwestern United States, which is also interesting.
Right.
And it normally produces flowers that open at night. So they would attract, in this case, they're not pollinated by bats particularly, but they're pollinated by hawk moths, which are big moths that are sometimes mistaken for bats because they're so big. And they hover like bats. They're really pretty interesting. And the plants release benzyl acetone, which is what attracts the hawk moths.
Is it a smell or aroma?
It's a like a pheromone.
It's an
attractant, a chemical soup.
By the way, this plant that's a night blooming plant, but it needs fire to help it out.
Right.
Remember, I did that show on trees.
Right.
And it's called serotony.
Okay, plants that bloom after a fire.
Right, dependent on fire to crack open the seeds.
That's right,
the
that's
cones
right.
And all that. So
exactly.
So this flower is similar.
That's exactly right. So when the plants are attacked by hawk moth larvae, right, they're threatened, they need to defend themselves because otherwise they'll be destroyed and they won't be pollinated. So when they're triggered by the oral secretions from the hawk moth larvae, they change. And they produce flowers that open in the morning and that have less emissions of benzyl acetone. And they attract hummingbirds as pollinators.
Oh, terrific.
I mean, that's just incredible.
Yeah, we think of plants as these poor, defenseless little things that everybody can eat and everything eats it. But they do have these defenses.
Tremendous defenses. And you think of them as passive. You think of them as just sitting there. And here, this is a very dynamic, busy, self-defending plant.
That's right. It makes me think of a little Shop of Horrors. Remember what happened in that place? So they were person-eating plants.
That's right. That's
and they attacked. Nobody was looking. It would sneak up on.
That's
but
right.
This is a simple form of that.
That's right.
They can change the critter they're attracting for pollination.
That's right. Protect themselves.
Protect themselves
so that they can reproduce.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's the goal of everything.
Right.
Reproduction.
Right. So, I mean, really fascinating stuff. All right.
Carol, you ready for another book? Oh, you're working on a book now.
Bed bug book, right? We're waiting for some feedback. I'm on a hiatus with the bed bug book.
Okay.
We gave the editor two really good chapters on control and on the biology of bed bugs. And she sent me a note over the weekend saying, I'm writing a summary of my comments now. So we're in a waiting mode.
We're waiting.
Okay, so now I'm going to switch to something very interesting about bacterial ecosystems.
Yeah,
I don't know, you mentioned that. I'm trying to think about where to start because it's very complicated. Let's assume our audience is not highly sophisticated about bacterial ecosystems. I had absolutely knew nothing about it. So the human gut, which is what scientists like to call our innards.
Oh, digestive tract, I guess.
Is filled with 100 trillion symbiotic bacteria. Okay? 10 times more microbial cells than our own cells, which in itself is interesting.
Yeah.
And they represent about 1,000 species, about 1,000 different species.
In our gut.
In the gut.
Mm.
Yet, if you're to eat a piece of chicken with a little salmonella bacteria on it, your immune system tends to go crazy, and you have an inflammatory response to those bacteria, right? I have had that. Did you ever have salmonella? Yeah.
I don't know what it was, but traveling, you get it, you know, whatever.
I got it on Chamber Street in Manhattan.
Oh, on Chamber Street,
yeah,
okay.
In an Indian restaurant that had a steam table with no heat under it. We had different dishes.
Yeah.
And the person I had all vegetarian dishes, but we're waving to a person who's outside the window.
Wait, stick to bacteria.
I'm
please.
Trying.
Come on.
Anyway, so, salmonella really gets you. It right. makes you very sick.
Yeah.
So
that's a bacteria.
It's a bacteria. Right. So okay. what decides? They don't. They aren't very different. Salmonella and other pathogenic bacteria don't look very much different from this thousand species of bacteria in our gut that we live with and ignore. And the question is, one question is, what decides whether we react or not? I mean, this is a paradox that's been around for a long time. How does the immune system distinguish between beneficial and pathogenic organisms, okay? Mm-hmm. And the ones that are beneficial are called commensal gut bacteria.
Yeah, that means feeding at the same table.
Correct.
All right.
And they provide nutrients and other benefits to their hosts without causing harm. Mm-hmm. That's the main thing about that. Now let's see.
So we have to talk about the ones that are not.
Right. Wait, there's some. I'm not even going to talk about this. There's some research about what stimulates the inflammatory response in the face of something like salmonella.
Mm-hmm.
And why it doesn't happen with bacteria that's good. And also why in certain types of immune disorders, for example, inflammatory bowel disease, the same bacteria that are sitting in your and my gut and perfectly happy cause an inflammatory response that can be very severe.
Right.
So why do those patients get sick when they're rejecting
bacteria?
Their own bacteria that is happy yeah. in everybody else's
gut. It's like autoimmune gut. Kind of
correct,
thing.
Correct, exactly. Right? Okay. So.
So we're getting down to nuts and bolts here of bacteria?
It's interesting, but it's complicated to explain it. Okay.
Okay.
So now, this is the recent research. We all know that in the early 1900s, scientists discovered that there were four different blood types, right?
Right.
And that was a way to classify everybody.
Right.
We all have our blood tested, and it's beneficial in many ways to know what your blood type is so that you can be treated and get transfusions and not reject the substances. Okay, now they have discovered that there are three distinct bacterial ecosystems in the guts of people that they have studied. So that now not only do we have a blood type, but we have a bug type or an ecosystem type.
Bacterial
ecosystem type. And there's only three kinds, so which is really interesting.
Really? Hmm.
They call them enterotypes.
Oh, internal.
Enterotypes, yeah. E-N-T-E-R-O.
Okay.
There's no link between ethnic background. They studied Europeans, Americans, Japanese. They found no connection to sex, to weight, because there's some thought that there's some connection with obesity,
yeah.
But they couldn't find any connection. They didn't have a huge number.
So you're born to this type.
That's one of the hypotheses.
I mean, blood type we inherit probably from our...
That we inherit. We know that, because you can only have a certain blood type based on your parents. But they didn't find any connection between health, state of health, or age. And they're now looking for other explanations. I suppose one of them is heredity. They said one possibility is that the guts or intestines of infants are randomly colonized by different pioneering species of microbes.
Mm-hmm.
And these microbes aid in food digestion, right? They synthesize vitamins, they use enzymes that our own cells can't make. And each of the types has a unique balance of the enzyme. So each one is different. Enterotype 1 produces more enzymes for making vitamin B7. That's biotin, right? Enterotype 2 makes more enzymes for thiamine, B1. I mean, it's just incredible.
Yeah.
And, of course, if once this develops, you can imagine, just like with blood types, it would be enormously useful. Doctors could tailor diets or drug prescriptions to suit people's enterotypes once it's really teased out how all the specifics of how the enterotypes differ from one another. You could see it as finding an alternative to antibiotics. But if you knew what the body would do with a particular substance, you might not need an antibiotic. So instead of trying to wipe out the disease-causing bacteria, you can just provide reinforcements for the good bacteria, right?
Now, what if you give a type 1 person bacteria from a type 2 person? Will they take up residence and be happy?
Well, all of these things are to be determined, right? Yeah. This is very early days in this research. Mm-hmm. They've been mapping the diversity of microbes in the human body for a while. As I said, they already know there are about 1,000 species, so they've been very busy doing this. I think that's... It's just tremendous variety. Many species that live in one person's mouth, for example, are completely missing from somebody else's.
Hmm.
So I think I have another piece of this that I want to talk about.
How does kissing come into this? What do you think?
What do you think?
Well, you know, people may not be compatible.
That's right.
With their endobacteria.
Maybe that's the answer, right?
Maybe that's the answer. You know what I mean?
They don't have it. We say, what do we say? You don't get good vibes? Maybe say you don't get good
bacteria.
Good bacteria.
I can see already there's going to be a network for this. It could be a program, right?
Absolutely.
Like
Facebook.
This is going to be Mouthbook.
Right. You have... Right,
enterotype
1 has its own Facebook, enterotype 2,
right. 3.
Okay. So now here's another one step further, right?
Another type?
This is about insects where the bacterium put them on an evolutionary fast track. So it causes a lot of arthropods, which are invertebrates that include insects and crustaceans. I always define the word arthropods in my books because I always have to think, what is an arthropod?
Jointed legs?
Invertebrates, insects, and crustaceans. Yeah. They all have same thing, symbiotic bacteria that they have inherited. And the sweet potato whitefly, which is an agricultural pest, you will be interested to know, has acquired a new bacterium.
Mm-hmm.
So this is from the genus Rickettsia. Now, I didn't have time to look that up, but that sounds familiar. Rickettsia is something I know something about, but I didn't have time to look it up, so I'm sorry. But in the year 2000, 1% of white flies had this bacterium in their systems, right? In 2008, 94% of white flies were infected with this bacterium.
Uh-huh.
So in other words, it has taken over, and it's an evolutionary change in this insect. It's now a difference. It's got a new, what would you call it? A new component.
A new endotypic bacteria.
Right.
But
its whole self is changed now because it now has a host for a new bacteria.
Okay. So.
And so what?
So what? Right.
That's what Bernie's ready to ask me. So what? Well, the white flies that have this, that are infected with this Rickettsia bacterium, are more fit. That's so what?
They're more fit.
So it's a very positive development. At least when they test them in the laboratory, they're more fit. Compared with uninfected white flies, ones that are infected develop faster, are more likely to survive to adulthood, and lay more eggs.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, again, you say natural selection. That's why it's spread so much, because it's at least one way of understanding it is because it's so beneficial.
Right. We don't know. Was it a mutation originally to change this?
It's a bacterium. We don't know how it's... Some of them had it. 1% had it. But it, because it was beneficial...
So it sped through the whole population.
It sped through... Right. It induces insects to produce a large number of daughters. And that's advantageous for the bacterium because it's passed to the next generation by the females.
Okay.
So, and they, these sweet potato white flies flourish in the Southwest. Mm. And although they're agricultural pests, they're more fit agricultural pests than they were before, and they lay more eggs.
That's bad news for the farmers.
Right, exactly.
For the sweet potato farmers.
But it's really interesting how they call this is a bacterial symbiont, right? It's a symbiotic bacteria. Really changed the biology of the insect. That's the way to say it.
Okay.
And now this has very interesting implications for pest management.
Uh-huh, okay.
Because we would like to know, are we getting a signal?
Not yet.
Okay. We'd like to know whether a bacteria can make an insect, here it's making it a worse pest, right? But
yeah.
If you could, one of the struggles with bed bugs is that it's difficult to kill them with residual insecticides because they don't, I'll put it in very simple terms, they don't lick their feet. So that you, with a residual insecticide, cockroaches, for example, will walk on the poison and then they lick their tarsi and they ingest the insecticide and they die. It would be very interesting if you could have a bacterium that would be spread throughout a colony and would have a lethal effect.
Mm.
Because they've been trying all kinds of things to find some way to attack bed bug populations. And one of the problems is that so far there isn't a way to do it. And this is very interesting in terms of pest control, whether there is some way that a bacterium could have a role. So instead of making them better and healthier, you
right.
could use it to eliminate
to weaken
a pest.
Them.
Yeah,
or make them receptive to
right because they can be dry. They can be desiccated.
Who
you
can?
Know? Bed bugs can be desiccated.
They can go for a long time like that, right?
But and you can use a desiccating agent from the outside that dries them. But if you could desiccate them from the inside, that would also help. Some bacterium
right.
that would desiccate them.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I think all this is interesting. Okay.
All right. So I think you have his buggy already here today.
I think I'm going to stop because the other piece that I wanted to talk about is about birds mating and people. Duck penises,
really?
Which spiral, are a spiral shape.
Wait, left or right? Are they left-handed?
I actually
and right-handed?
Have even pictures of them. I could answer that if you give me a minute. Counterclockwise.
Counterclockwise, okay? Spiraling penises.
See, he asks me all these questions I can never answer. Now I can answer this one.
All right. Well, that's important to know.
I'll do it on the next show.
All right.
And I'll tell all about it because they studied the penile eversion of Muscovy ducks, but we'll leave that as a cliffhanger.
You know, the Muscovy duck is the commercial duck that we all eat.
Okay, well, so much more important to know about.
That's right, which way they're spiraling.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you for listening. I hope this was interesting. This is The Naturalist with Carol Butler.
And Bernie Wides, and we go off with the New World Symphony.
Right.
Which
right.
is appropriate for this discussion today.
I guess so.
Okay. Thank you, Carol, for
Bye,
doing all that research.
Thank you.
And we'll be back this next week's show. And the next show is going to be on gardening.
Gardening, right.
On the 27th, I think, of June. So it'll be something completely different, and we'll talk about raising food, your own food, and the importance of gardening.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. On the PR Newswire, I read about a new drink that is being brewed up in Utah. It's called Crio Brew, C-R-I-O-B-R-U, and it's turning heads in the coffee world. Crio Brew is a healthy and delicious brewed cocoa drink. It has the essence and health properties of dark chocolate and brews just like coffee. It's made with one ingredient, 100% cocoa beans, which are roasted and milled to produce flavorful cocoa grounds. Because it is roasted and brewed, it has the consistency, roasted flavor, and complexity of a coffee. And yet, because it is made with cacao beans, its primary flavor is chocolate. And just as with coffee, sweetener and creamer can be added to taste, or you can drink it black for a bittersweet and purportedly low-calorie beverage. Just as with coffee, sweetener and creamer can be added to taste, or it can be drunk black for a bittersweet, low-calorie drink. If you want more information about this new revelation on the beverage market, I suggest that you visit their website at www.criobrew.com. That's spelled C-R-I-O-B-R-U.com. This has been Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.
Check out a small clip of Chef Smarty Pants, a.k.a. Erica Wides, talking about radishes on her show, Why We Cook.
Those supermarket radishes were like that. They were all heat and no flavor and woody and tough, and they were always kind of beat up and buggy looking, and they looked like crap. I don't understand why they were sold, and they were in that plastic bag all sealed up for like 6 months. Why buy them? We always put them into our salad growing up, and I would just pick them out. And my mom still buys them. She still buys those bags. To me, those bags of radishes are like the ultimate symbol of industrial produce. They're grown for size and for color, but they taste like balls of wood dipped in nail polish remover. I don't understand why people would eat them. So I never understood the appeal of the radish until...
Want to hear more? Tune in live to Why We Cook every Tuesday at 6:30 p.m., where you can find all the old shows on our archives. Also, subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. Thanks for listening. The following is a message from HeritageFoodsUSA.com. The difference between wild Alaskan salmon and farmed Atlantic salmon is just as great as the differences between commodity pork and heritage breed pork. Huge! HeritageFoodsUSA.com is lining up a major social buy of sustainably harvested salmon in July and offering it at a phenomenal price to consumers. Check out HeritageFoodsUSA.com for more details on how to get in on this opportunity. Experience salmon the way it should be. The following is a public service announcement from Just Food. Help bring live chickens into food challenge communities through your donations to the Just Food City Chicken Project 2011. The City Chicken Project would not be possible without the volunteer hours, donations large and small, and the vibrant energy and ideas of the communities we work with. Just Food is a nonprofit organization that connects New York City communities and local and urban farmers with the resources and support they need to make fresh, locally grown food accessible to all. To donate, search on Kickstarter.com for Just Food and find their City Chicken Project. For more information on Just Food, visit justfood.org or call 212-645-9880. That's 212-645-9880. Let's keep making New York City a better place to live and eat.